From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, listening to LBJ's secret White House tapes. During his years as president, Lyndon Johnson recorded many of his conversations. The tapes reveal Johnson's doubts about the war in Vietnam and his thoughts on the assassination of President Kennedy. We feature an interview with historian Michael Beschloss, who transcribed, edited, and annotated the tapes for his book, Taking Charge. Also, what Nixon never wanted the country to hear. We talk with historian Stanley Cutler about the most recently released Nixon White House tapes and the evidence they provide about Nixon's culpability in the Watergate cover-up. And film critic John Powers sizes up this year's Oscar nominees. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says Russia's objections to possible military strikes against Iraq won't prevent the Allies from acting. Moscow has urged the Clinton administration to avoid striking Iraq and allow diplomatic efforts time to solve the standoff between Baghdad and the United Nations. President Clinton says he has always supported diplomacy.
I have bent over backwards for months now to try to achieve a diplomatic solution. I am still working with the Russians, the French, the United Nations, anybody to try to find a diplomatic solution. The difference here is that I simply do not believe it is acceptable to permit Iraq to walk away from its obligations.
U.S. Army General Henry Shelton, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says Iraq has rebuilt its air defenses since the Gulf War and will pose a serious threat to U.S. and British pilots in the event of any such attack. Meanwhile, the United States and Japan are united in their Iraqi positions. The American ambassador to the U.N., Bill Richardson, appeared at a news conference today with Japan's foreign minister. The BBC's Julie Hindle reports.
The Japanese foreign minister, Keizo Obuchi, said that he hoped diplomatic efforts would be successful, but that Japan agreed with the United States that Iraq represented a threat to the region and the world that was too dangerous to ignore. By supporting all possible options, Japan is apparently giving tacit consent to the use of force against Saddam Hussein should diplomacy fail. But Mr. Obuchi added that the United States has yet to make a final decision on the use of force. Neither side gave any indication about a timetable for a diplomatic solution, but both sides said time was running short. Ambassador Bill Richardson said the solution lies in Saddam Hussein's hands. Juliet Hindle, Tokyo.
The United States has won the silver and bronze medals in the two-man luge competition at the Olympic Games. NPR's Tom Goldman reports from Nagano.
The sledding sport of luge has been an Olympic event since 1964, and up until today, all 87 medals awarded had gone to four countries, Germany, Austria, Italy, and the former Soviet Union. Now there's a fifth, the United States, where luge is merely a blip on the sport's radar screen. Chris Thorpe from Michigan and Gordy Shear from New York State took the silver medal, missing the two-man title by just 0.02 seconds. Thorpe and Shear won the overall World Cup championship in 1996-97. They were considered medal contenders going into today's competition, in which the sliders lie on their backs, one on top of the other. Third place went to Americans Mark Grimet, also from Michigan, and Brian Martin from California. The gold medal went to Stefan Krauss and Jan Behrendt of Germany. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Nagano, Japan.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 18 points at 83.51. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market has drifted lower following three record-setting sessions. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Some analysts are saying the market is taking a much-needed rest, with the Dow having gained nearly 190 points during the previous three sessions. Today's negative tone was prompted in part by overnight weakness in many of the key Asian stock markets. Much of the decline is being led by banking issues, which are down after Prudential Securities reduced these shares to a hold rating, on the view that slowing Asian economies will be a drag on earnings growth. Meanwhile, in the Treasury market, bond prices have fallen from their best levels of the day following a stronger-than-expected reading on February consumer confidence. I'm Doug Krisner.
Union Pacific Railroad and Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railway say they have agreed on a plan to clear up some of the country's most congested rail lines. The plan calls for both companies to set up a joint regional dispatching center for all train operations in the Gulf Coast region. The railroads will share interest in the line between Houston and New Orleans, once owned by Southern Pacific. Union Pacific bought much of Southern Pacific during a merger in 1996. The marriage did not go smoothly. Many rail customers have been unable to ship goods like crops and chemicals because of snafus in Union Pacific's rail lines. The studio behind the upcoming Lost in Space movie has launched a $100 million lawsuit against Little Caesars. New Line Cinema claims the pizza chain reneged on a deal to promote the film. Little Caesars calls the suit unfounded. Again on Wall Street, the Dow is down 18 points at 83.51. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, we get a head start on President's Day. During Lyndon Johnson's years as president, he recorded many of his conversations with people ranging from Martin Luther King and J. Edgar Hoover to his own tailor and barber. The tapes were released by his widow, Lady Bird. They offer surprising insights into Johnson's use of power and his thoughts about Vietnam, the civil rights movement, and the Kennedy assassination. Historian Michael Beschloss edited, annotated, and compiled the tapes made during LBJ's first year in the White House for his book Taking Charge, The Johnson White House Tapes, 1963-64. Beschloss is also the author of four previous books on American presidents and is a frequent commentator on the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Terry spoke with him last October.
Michael Beschloss, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I want to start with one of the excerpts of the Johnson tapes. Now, this isn't one of the more politically profound excerpts, but it is a very interesting one. And this is with Eddie Sands. Explain to us what we're about to hear.
Eddie Sands is a New York hairdresser, and it's December of 1963, and LBJ calls him up. LBJ was a bit of a control freak. He not only wanted to control what his wife's hair looked like and his daughter's hair looked like, but even his secretaries. He said, if I'm going to have to look at, for instance, Yolanda, one of his secretaries over the Christmas holidays, she's going to have to get a bale of hair cut off, he says in another conversation. So here Johnson is calling up Eddie Sands, this hairdresser in New York, to get him to come down and do all these haircuts and also to negotiate a fee. And before we begin, you should remember that Johnson at this point is worth about $12 million, but he's trying to get Sands' price down.
Let's hear it.
Mr. Sands?
Yes, sir.
This is Lyndon Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, yes, sir.
Can I talk to you now without getting in the paper and getting it advertised?
Oh, surely.
If not, I won't talk to somebody else, but I hope I can. But I don't want it in any of these columns now, and I don't want it to get out. And Mr. Roosevelt said one of the most valuable men he had in his vicinity destroyed his usefulness because he had to advertise it.
Now, Mr. Johnson, I give you my solemn word as a gentleman.
All right. Now, I'm a poor man. I don't make much money, but I got a wife and a couple of daughters and four or five people that run around with me, and I like the way you make them look. Now, how much...
I'm most flattered, I promise you. Take my word for it, but this is incompetence.
Well, this is your country, and I want to see what you want to do about it. Now, how can you come down here and make them look better?
When do you want me to come?
Well, it depends first on how much it'll cost me.
It won't cost you anything to worry about, sir.
All right. I just have to live off of a paycheck, and I'm in debt, but I want to see if you can't come, and I don't know whether the planes are flying this morning, but if you can't come, and stay till 5 or 6 o'clock this evening. If you can't do that, I'll have to wait till next year.
No, I believe we can arrange that, and I think we can manage this. I have a very important appointment with this. I'd be very happy to cancel, and I will come by myself.
All right, now bring whoever you need, and we'll pay their transportation, but we can't pay you much else.
Don't you ever worry about that,
Mr.
Johnson, I'm going to try to get a plane out this morning.
You just come right on and then call Ms. Roberts in my office and tell her what time you'll arrive, and I'll have a White House car meet you.
You bet, sir. Ms. Roberts, should I call?
Okay, that's LBJ and his hairdresser recorded in 1963. Michael Beschloss, what is revealing about this?
Well, what is revealing is that Johnson was a huge micromanager. He wanted to control almost every relationship around him. And that was politically really helpful because Johnson wanted to get huge things done for the country, war on poverty, civil rights, all sorts of other things, and he was a master in dealing with senators and congressmen of a kind that we've rarely seen in the 20th century. But when it gets to his human relationships, members of his family, members of his staff, it gets a little bit more intense, as you can see.
He had told his secretary to keep these tapes secret until 50 years after his death. Why are they being made public now?
Actually, he said even more than that. There was a scene just about a week before Johnson died of a heart attack, January of 1973. He was sitting in his library in this huge white corduroy, this gargantuan custom-built chair that Johnson liked to sit in, and this aide, Mildred Stiegel, came in, and Johnson said, "As I've told you before, if anything happens to me and I'm not feeling well and I don't think I'm going to live long, I want you to make sure that these tapes will be concealed for at least 50 years after my death, and as far as I'm concerned, most of them should never be opened." That was the case for years after Johnson's death in 73. His family honored that. Most people in the United States didn't even know that Johnson had taped. Then by the early 1990s, they were in a very different situation. Scholars were suing for release of the Nixon tapes. There was a very different concept of openness. These were tapes, for instance, that were made on tape recorders that were paid for by the government. And I think what the Johnson circle felt was that perhaps it would be better, before there were any efforts made to force the tapes out, better to do it voluntarily and also perhaps show some self-confidence in Johnson's record and leadership.
I think one of the places that these LBJ tapes are most revealing have to do with his reservations about the war in Vietnam. And one of the clips that you've brought with you from the LBJ tapes really indicates the reservations that he had. And this is from a conversation he was having with McGeorge Bundy on May 27th of 1964. Introduce this tape for us. Put this in context for us before we hear it.
May 1964, Johnson was getting enormous pressure from the Joint Chiefs of Staff to go in whole hog to Vietnam, escalate the fighting a great deal. That hadn't happened yet. There were still only about 16,000 advisors there. And Johnson is trying to decide in his own mind whether this is a good thing or not, and he's very much tortured. He knows he's getting pressure from the Joint Chiefs. He knows he's going to be denounced by the Republicans, like Richard Nixon or Barry Goldwater, as soft if he doesn't do what the Joint Chiefs say. At the same time, he knows, and this is a big surprise, as early as the spring of 1964, that the odds are very much against America ever winning a war in Vietnam.
And what has set up this particular conversation?
What happened was the government in Saigon, the South Vietnamese government, which was allied with the United States, was collapsing. The Viet Cong and others who were allied with them were making huge inroads, and basically the Joint Chiefs were telling Johnson, Fisher cut bait.
So this is Lyndon Johnson with McGeorge Bundy, Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs.
I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like me, we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. I believe the Chinese Communists coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess.
It's an awful mess.
And we just got to think about I look at this sergeant of mine this morning, got six little old kids over there, and he's getting out my things and bringing me in my night reading and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought about ordering those kids in there. And what in the hell am I ordering him out there for?
One thing
that
is
Vietnam worth to me? What is Laos worth to me? What is it worth to this country?
Now we
got a treaty, but hell, everybody else got a treaty out there, and they're not doing anything about it. Now, of course, if you start running the communists, they may just chase you right into your own kitchen.
That's the trouble. And that is what the rest of that half of the world is going to think if this thing comes apart on us. That's the dilemma. That's exactly the dilemma.
But everybody I talk to that's got any sense in here, they just says, oh, my God, please give us thought. Of course, I was reading Mansfield's stuff this morning, and it's just milquetoast as it can be. He got no spine at all.
Yeah.
But this is a terrible thing we're getting ready to do.
Mr. President, I just think it's the biggest, it's the only big decision in one sense that was, has, this one is one we're having, that we either reach up and get it or we let it go by, and I'm not telling you today what I'd do in your position. I just think the most we have to do is to pray with it for another while.
Did you see the poll this morning? 65% of them don't know anything about it.
It
and of those that do, the majority think we're mishandling it, but they don't know what to do. That's Gallup.
Yeah.
And it's damned easy to get in war, but it's going to be awfully hard to ever extricate yourself if you get in.
I'm very sensitive to the fact that people who are having trouble with an intransigent problem find it very easy to come and say to the President of the United States, go and be tough.
It's one of the Lyndon Johnson White House tapes recently released. Michael Beschloss has edited a book of those tapes. He's a historian who's written extensively about presidents. What amazes me listening to that excerpt that we just heard is that Johnson is making a lot of the arguments that the anti-war demonstrators were later to make. He's making them himself.
Exactly, and making them in private. And this is one of the ways that these tapes really show an inner Johnson that's so different from what we saw at the time. In public, he was saying, we must stand in Vietnam. In private, we now know he thought that this was something that could be one of the worst tragedies in American history, as it turned out to be. And it's so different from, for instance, you know, the Oliver Stone view of Johnson. You remember when in JFK, Johnson comes to office, comes to power, and is just desperate to get involved in Vietnam to help the military-industrial complex. That's a very different portrait.
The incident that really got us very deep into the war and into bombing Vietnam was one of our U.S. destroyers was attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin by the North Vietnamese. And it was attacked once, and then Johnson had gotten a report that it was attacked again, although that report turned out not to be true. And it was after that second alleged attack that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was passed and we started bombing North Vietnam. Now, you have a conversation with Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, talking to Johnson about this alleged second attack. Set this up for us.
Well, here Johnson is. This is Johnson's notification that there is evidence that there's a second attack on the destroyer Maddox in the Gulf of Tonkin, and Johnson is faced with a very big decision, whether to do nothing or whether to retaliate by bombing North Vietnam, which will escalate the war and get America into a totally new dimension. And here he hears for the first time that this is alleged to have happened.
President, we just had word by telephone from Admiral Sharp that the destroyer is under torpedo attack. I think I might get Dean Rusk and Mac Bundy and have them come over here, and we'll go over these retaliatory actions, and then we ought to...
Sure, I think you'll agree with that, yeah.
And I've got a category here. I'll call it to them.
Now, where are these torpedoes coming from?
Well, we don't know. Presumably from these unidentified craft that I mentioned to you a moment ago. We thought that the unidentified craft might include one PT boat, which has torpedo capability, and two SWAT top boats, which we don't credit with torpedo capability, although they may have it.
What are these planes are doing around while they're being attacked?
Well, presumably the planes are attacking the ships. We don't have any word from Sharp on that. The planes would be in the area at the present time, all eight of them.
Okay. Now you get them over there, and then you come over here as soon as you can.
I'll do that, yeah.
Michael Beschloss, what did you learn from hearing this conversation?
What I learned was that Johnson was given a pretty flat report that there had very likely been a second attack, and that led to the events of later that day. And as you hear further on later tapes, what happens is that late afternoon, the Joint Chiefs and McNamara, the defense secretary, are sort of looking at the evidence. Was there a second attack or not? And the evidence is very mixed. Then you hear on a tape about 5 o'clock p.m., McNamara calls up Johnson and says, oh, my God, there's been a press leak. And the press leak was a report that had appeared on a wire service that there had indeed been a second attack. And what happened was, this is another one of these tragic moments in history, Johnson was faced with a horrible choice. Either go on and decide perhaps that there had been no second attack and announce that, and if he had done that, then probably Barry Goldwater, the Republican nominee for president, and the Republicans would have stomped him and said, Johnson is covering up, Johnson's a coward, Johnson's not retaliating. Either do that or bomb North Vietnam, quell those suspicions, but drag America into the beginning of the Vietnam War, and that latter course is ultimately what Johnson did.
Are you saying in a way that Johnson got us deeper into war for American political reasons, you know, so that he wouldn't be called a coward, so that he could get reelected?
One of the worst things that can happen in American history is when big foreign policy and military decisions have to be made during the heat of a campaign. And that week in August of 1964 was probably the worst example of that, because Barry Goldwater had just been nominated one of the most militaristic party nominees probably in American history for president, was charging Johnson with being a softie, and Johnson is given this terrible choice and ultimately chose to do this largely for political reasons.
My guest is historian Michael Beschloss. He's edited the first volume of LBJ's White House tapes. The book is called Taking Charge. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with historian Michael Beschloss. He's edited the first volume of Lyndon Johnson's White House tapes. The book is called Taking Charge. One of the dramas that you actually hear when you listen back to these tapes, or when you read the transcripts in your book Taking Charge, is that at the same time Johnson is going through this crisis about what should he do in Vietnam, he's also going through a lot of crises about what should he do with the civil rights movement here in America. And they're both weighing on his mind a lot. And I want to play a tape that you've brought with you of J. Edgar Hoover, then head of the FBI, telling Johnson the latest on the three missing civil rights workers, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, missing in Mississippi. And Hoover's about to report that their car was found totally burned. Do you want to say something about this tape, Michael Beschloss, before we hear it?
It's chilling, and it just really makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. This was 4 days after Johnson had gotten his big victory in the Senate on the Civil Rights Bill, June of 1964, and he was at that point terrified that the South was going to rise up, white Southerners, in anger against blacks because the Civil Rights Bill had been passed. He was worried throughout 1964 that there could be a serious race war with riots that could get even worse. And so he's just on tenterhooks waiting for any sign that this is going to be touched off. And then he gets the news that these three civil rights workers in Mississippi have been lost. And then Hoover calls to tell what has become of the car in which they were driving.
Well, here's that conversation.
Mr. President,
yeah.
I wanted to let you know we have found the car.
Yeah.
Now, this is not known. Nobody knows this at all. But the car was burned, and we do not know yet whether any bodies are inside of the car because of the intense heat that still is in the area of the car. This is off to the side of the road. It wasn't going toward Meridian, but is going in the opposite direction. Now, whether there are any bodies in the car, we won't know until we can get into the car ourselves. But I did want you to know that apparently what's happened, these men have been killed. Although, as I say, we can't tell whether anybody's in there in view of the intense heat.
Well, now, what would make you think they've been killed?
Because of the fact that it is the same car that they were in Philadelphia, Mississippi. It is merely an assumption that probably they were burned in the car. On the other hand, they may have been taken out and killed on the outside.
Or maybe kidnapped and locked up.
How's that?
Or maybe kidnapped and locked up.
Well, I would doubt whether those people down there would even give them that much of a break.
How long has the car been burnt, you reckon? 6-8 hours?
Well, we frankly don't know. The intense heat would have indicated that the car probably had been burning for maybe 6 hours or 5 or 6 hours.
Well, looks like those fellas jumped out of the car and burned it.
Well, you would think they would unless they'd been bound and were locked in that car and then the car set afire.
Well, why wouldn't an agent be able to look at a car and see if there's any bones in it?
See whether there are any bodies in it?
Any bones, yeah.
Well, the reason for that is the car is so burned and charred with heat that you can't get close to it.
Okay, you call me as soon as you can. Now, this group's coming down here to see Lee White, my assistant.
Yes.
You think in the light of this that this congressman, both of them were able to help me to see him? You think I ought to step in, just tell him I've talked to you and you're doing everything you can?
I think it would be all right. I don't like to have you having to see these people because we're going to have more cases like this down south. And every time that it occurs, they're going to have these families come on here to Washington. And, of course, the congressmen, being politically minded, they'll want you to see them.
J. Edgar Hoover talking to LBJ in 1964. Michael Beschloss.
I was just going to say that the denouement was that the bodies were not found in the car. There was a search, and it took 6 weeks. And then finally, 6 weeks later, they found that the three men had been shot by the side of the road almost immediately and their bodies buried in a dam.
What did you learn from going through the LBJ tapes about his genuine commitment to the civil rights movement? How much of it was politics? How much of it was a genuine commitment?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I think tends to get obscured by Vietnam, that Johnson, for all his flaws, there really was a bottom line with the man. There was a core of conviction that caused him to take very big political risks. One of them was, I think, for the poor, and the other was for blacks. You know, when Johnson came back from Dallas after Kennedy's murder, November of 1963, there was every political reason in the world for him to say, let's set this civil rights bill aside for a year until I get elected, then I will not be an accidental president. He knew that in 1963 that when John Kennedy submitted a civil rights bill to Congress, it dropped his popularity ratings 22 points. So Johnson had no reason to think that wouldn't happen to him. Instead, he gets back to Washington the night of the assassination, is advised by political advisors, set this civil rights bill aside, and he basically says, what's the presidency for? Even if it costs me my reelection, this will be something that have been good to have paid for it with.
And, you know, you mentioned that Kennedy had wanted Johnson to be on the sidelines in terms of the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act because he wanted Johnson to be able to still carry the South. And he was
That's
afraid,
it.
Yeah, go ahead.
And Johnson, as vice president, was very frustrated because privately he was very pro-civil rights, but publicly Kennedy was saying, I need you to help us hold the South in 1964, so don't get too far out front on civil rights.
Michael Beschloss is the author of Taking Charge, The Johnson White House Tapes, 1963 to 64. We'll hear more of Terry's conversation with him in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Additional support comes from Rising Tide Entertainment, presenting the soundtrack for The Apostle, featuring Lyle Lovett, Stephen Curtis Chapman, The Sounds of Blackness, and others. Available in record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lyndon Johnson considers pulling out of the 1964 presidential campaign. More with historian Michael Beschloss. Also, we'll hear about the most recent Nixon tapes with historian Stanley Cutler. And film critic John Powers looks at this year's Oscar nominees. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's continue Terry's interview with historian Michael Beschloss. His book about Lyndon Johnson's tenure in the White House is called Taking Charge.
You have brought a very dramatic tape with you, and this is made the night before President Johnson is nominated at the Democratic Convention for what would be his second term. The first term was when he succeeded Kennedy after the assassination. And he's telling his press secretary, George Reedy, that he's considering pulling out of the race and just retiring. And you can hear in this how the war and the civil rights movement have really weighed on him. And I was really surprised to hear these reservations. Were you?
I was. And what I was mainly surprised about was to get a sense of LBJ's emotions. This is someone who, as I was suggesting earlier in private, had these enormous mood swings that were very great, even in those of us who were not political leaders. And here he's in a situation where he should be having the thrill of his life. He's about to be nominated unanimously by the Democrats in Atlantic City. He knows that he's likely to defeat Barry Goldwater in probably the biggest landslide of the 20th century, yet he is so upset over press attacks, over the danger that there will be conflict between the races over civil rights. And also, this is 3 weeks after the escalation of the Vietnam War at the Gulf of Tonkin, that he literally is telling his press secretary, I am on the verge of throwing it all away and delivering a statement saying that I'm going to pull out my name and retire to Texas.
This is Lyndon Johnson, August 25th, 1964.
Yes. George Reedy on 9-0.
Yes, sir.
Except a brief.
Good.
What should I tell him about this morning?
I don't know, George. There's really not much to tell him.
That's what I think.
I'm just writing out a little statement that I think I'm going to make either at a press conference here or go up to Atlantic City this afternoon to make. But I don't think we can tell him about it now. And I guess that's all.
Right, incidentally, the Attorney General just announced for the New York State Senate.
Is he on TV, I wonder?
I don't know if he's on TV. I saw the ticker.
Uh-huh. Here's what I think I'm going to say to him, whatever number of months it is. 44 months ago, I was selected to be the Democratic Vice President. 44 months ago, I was elected to be the Democratic Vice President. In the time given me, I did my best. On that fateful November day last year, I accepted the responsibility of the President, asking God's guidance and the help of all of our people. For 9 months, I've carried on as effectively as I could. Our country faces grave dangers. These dangers must be faced and met by a united people under a leader they do not doubt. After 33 years in political life, most men acquire enemies as ships accumulate barnacles. The times require leadership about which there is no doubt, and a voice that men of all parties and sections and color can follow. I've learned after trying very hard that I'm not that voice or that leader. Therefore, and then I'm going to say therefore, I suggest that the representatives from all states of this union selected for the purpose of selecting a Democratic nominee and for president and vice president proceed to do their duty and that no consideration be given to me because I'm absolutely unavailable. That's, I think then they can just pick the two they want for the two places. We'll take the nominee and do the best we can to help him till January. And then if he's elected, well, that's fine. I think he will be. And he can have a new and fresh fellow without any of the old scars. And I don't want this power of the bomb, and I just don't want these decisions I'm being required to make. And I don't want the conniving that's required. I don't want the disloyalty that's around. I don't want the bumbling and the inefficiencies. And our people and all of them talk too much.
This will throw the nation quite an uproar, sir.
Yeah, I think so. And I think now's the time. I don't know any better time. They're there and they've got nothing else to do. And I'm absolutely positive that I cannot lead the South, the North and the South. And I don't want to lead the nation without my own state, without my own section. I'm very convinced that the Negroes will not listen to me. They're not going to call a white Southerner. And I think the stakes are too big to try to compromise. I looked at the Herald Tribune. There's nothing but things that we've done terrible. I read the New York Times. We had a pallid platform. That is outrageous. I picked up every paper I had this morning. We had just played hell. And there's just bound to be a lot of people that don't have these doubts, and these angers, and these barnacles, and these things they have to carry, and the nation ought to have a chance to get the best available. That's who I want my children to have. And I know that I'm not.
I think it's too late, Sir Lee. I know it's your decision because you're the man that has to bear the brunt. But right now, I think this just gives the country to Goldwater.
Well, that's all right. I don't care. I'm just willing to. I don't think that. I don't agree with that thought. But I think he can do better than I can.
He can't, sir. He's just a child. And look at our side. We don't have anybody. The only men around I'd trust to be president would be McNamara, and he wouldn't stand a chance.
No, but we don't. We didn't trust any of the rest of them. You know, we didn't trust Eisenhower or Jack Kennedy, any of that. That's a matter for them. Anyway, they've been running their business for a couple hundred years, and I leave it up to them. And their processes can work without any dictation, without any influence from me. And I don't feel like it. I want to live with my wife and my daughters and the things are going through, like Time magazine this week and the lies that they published. I don't want to be the center of attention enough that they're interested in publishing that stuff. I just want to be away from it. And I know that that a man ought to have a hide of a rhinoceros to be in this job, but I don't have a hide of a rhinoceros, and I'm not seeking happiness. I'm just seeking a little comfort once in a while. Getting away from it, I think I've earned it after 33 years, and I don't see any reason why I must die in it.
I think you've earned it too, sir. But I don't think it's a question of having a hide of a rhinoceros. It's kind of a question arising above these things.
Well, I can't do that. I can't do that. I can't. I have a desire to unite people, and the South is against me, and the North's against me, and the Negroes are against me, and the press didn't really have an affection for me. Are an understanding, and I'm unable to give it to them. I try, but I just looking at the Philadelphia Inquirer this morning. Our friend Henry Brandon, whom I do not know, but
I doubt it.
It's a textbook caricature of a fast-dealing politician.
That's LBJ, August 25th, 1964, speaking with his press secretary, George Reedy. Michael Beschloss, I think, you know, there's two things that really surprised me hearing that tape. One was how wounded Johnson seemed to be by the bad press he was getting and by feeling that he'd lost a lot of the American public. But also, I was really surprised that he was willing to throw his party into such disarray, to pull out, you know, at the absolute last minute. I mean, this is the consummate politician, and he's willing to do that to his party?
Well, you know, people who are very depressed do things that seem otherwise a little bit irrational. And what happened after this conversation was he then went to see Lady Bird, and Lady Bird talked to him for a long time, and she knew her husband's emotions and mood swings very well. And she basically said, you know, if you do this, you're going to throw the country into a turmoil. She said, if you come back to Texas, you might start drinking again. You might be full of anger, and I don't want to be the target. And she later said in her diary, which I quote in the book, I do not know hours that I ever found more difficult.
Now, let me get back to the LBJ tapes. Do you think that these tapes have given you a pretty different view of the man and the presidency? Are you reevaluating his presidency based on what you've heard on these personal recordings?
Yes, I would. To begin with Vietnam, no one is ever going to say that Vietnam was anything but a tragedy for this country and that was a war that never should have been waged. But one thing that the tapes do show is that this was not a warmonger who came to power in November of 1963 after the Kennedy assassination. This was someone who was getting advice from different places and was very much torn. Ultimately, he made the wrong decision to go deeply into Vietnam, but it was not a decision that was made with absolutely no forethought, as many others have written about Johnson in those years.
Anything else that you've totally reevaluated?
I think another thing is that this was a man who actually meant what he said perhaps a little bit more than we had given him credit for. You know, presidents always like to sound idealistic in public, and the real question is whether there is a bottom line beyond which they will not go and for which they're willing to take political risks. And in Johnson's case, you see him expending an awful lot of political capital in 1964 for the war on poverty and also for the Civil Rights Bill. I just couldn't help but think when I was listening to this, if this were LBJ in the 1990s in the modern manner, he probably would have had focus groups and a lot of polls. And what they would have told him was, civil rights is a loser. You're going to give the South to the Republican Party for at least the next generation or more. And also the poor don't vote, so don't spend your capital on that in an election year. That's not advice that Johnson got, but if he did get it, he would not have heeded it.
Michael Beschloss, I thank you very much for talking with us and for playing some of these tapes for us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Michael Beschloss is the author of Taking Charge. Terry spoke with him last fall. Lyndon Johnson was not the only American president to have a secret taping system in the Oval Office. Nixon had one, too. Terry spoke with historian Stanley Cutler about how it worked.
Nixon's recording system was a little bit different than LBJ's. LBJ's
right.
was button-activated. He had to press a button and start recording. Nixon's system was voice-activated, so as soon as he started talking, the system started recording.
Right.
Do you think that everybody in his office was aware that their conversation with Nixon were being recorded?
Well, Haldeman knew because Haldeman helped install the system. People such as Kissinger, Ehrlichman did not know at first. I think over time they sense this. There are times when, for example, I think there's some strong evidence that Ehrlichman knew before he acknowledged knowing that the taping system existed. But with others who came in, they did not know. I think Haig knew from the outset. But these are indeed, as you said, a voice activated. I think at times it's very clear to me that there are some contrived conversations, particularly between Nixon and Haldeman, where they're talking for the record. Oh, I didn't know this. I don't know that. They're talking about deep black holes, you know, which is a kind of, it turns out to be a code for the plumbers. You know, sometimes you have a tape recorder going, and sometimes you then become oblivious to it, too, and you just talk.
We'll hear more about what was said in Nixon's Oval Office after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue Terry's conversation with historian Stanley Cutler. Nixon's White House tapes offer a far more detailed picture than we've ever had of his involvement in Watergate. Stanley Cutler transcribed and edited the tapes for his book, Abuse of Power. The first Nixon tapes, about 40 hours worth, were released in April of 1974. Nixon tried to prevent the release of the remaining tapes, but over 200 more hours of recordings were released as a result of a lawsuit filed by Cutler and the group Public Citizen. The tapes still can't leave the archives, so we can't play them on the radio. Cutler says these recordings provide an overwhelming record of Nixon's obstruction of justice and expose a level of culpability far greater than imagined 25 years ago. One of the big questions about Watergate is, why did Nixon try to cover it up instead of letting other people take the fall?
I think I've got another dimension to it. I think that the standard answer that I and others have often given for the institution of a cover-up is because there was a need to protect the president from the any revelation of the so-called White House horrors of the first term. That is, the existence of the plumbers, which engaged in illegal break-ins, and the Houston plan, which also authorized illegal break-ins, the IRS abuses, the enemies list, and so forth. Those are the standard reasons given for the cover-up. But here in these new tapes, Nixon on two occasions, one's when he's talking about the plumber's break-in of Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, and a second when he's talking about the authorization of illegal break-ins under the so-called Houston plan. He says, "I cannot admit that the President of the United States authorized illegal acts." It was a kind of psychological moment. Here was the man who for 25 years had championed himself as the advocate of law and order. The man of high-toned moral principles is now going to go out and admit that he authorized second-story men to engage in illegal break-ins for his administration. It was really more that he could bear to face.
What about Henry Kissinger? How does he come out looking in the tapes? I mean, Nixon thinks Kissinger is leaking to the press at some point.
Oh yeah. Well,
they have a quarrel between them about that. But what was Kissinger in on, and what did he actively participate in?
Well, you know, there is an obvious tension between these two men. Nixon is very unhappy, you know, when Kissinger gets a Nobel Prize, why not me? After all, didn't Kissinger take his orders from Nixon? He would resent if Kissinger became Man of the Year on Time magazine cover. There was a rivalry there. Well, throughout these tapes, his reference to Kissinger asking for wiretaps of his key National Security Council aides to find out who's leaking to the media, and Kissinger is up to his ears in that, and Nixon keeps reminding him of it. There are conversations, though, that in the eyes of many people today don't serve Kissinger very well. He appears to be the ultimate toady, buttering up the president. There is a conversation on the night of April 30th after Nixon has fired Haldeman and Ehrlichman, his key aides, and Kissinger has his conversation with him and tells Nixon again how great he is and that Watergate doesn't mean anything. History's going to remember Nixon as the great man of peace and so forth. Yet in his own memoirs, at the same time, in his diary, which appears in his memoirs, Kissinger says for the night of April 30th that he knew that Nixon was dead in the water at that point, that the administration was paralyzed and probably on the way out.
It's interesting to read some of Nixon's anti-Semitic language in his tirades. He says to Haldeman, "Bob, please get me the names of the Jews, you know, the big mm-hmm. Jewish contributors of the Democrats. Could we please investigate some of the expletives?" Then he criticized a reporter and FBI executive saying, "They're both Jews, and that has nothing to do with it, but it at least gives you a feeling of the possible motivation mm-hmm. deep down of the liberal leftists." Mm-hmm. Did you find this kind of anti-Semitic language recurring a lot in Nixon's
talk? Well, it recurs a good deal throughout these tapes. The people who leak in government are Jews. McGovern has big Jewish contributors. Well, you know, Nixon did too. He kind of ignores that. Now, you know, on this subject, his defenders and his associates, some of whom are Jewish. But by the way, you know, one should point out that he did have an ample representation of Jews in the government, Henry Kissinger, Leonard Garment, White House aide, and so forth. They'd like to point out that Nixon's anti-Semitism never became, quote, operational, unquote. Well, I never know quite exactly what to make of that. What do they mean? That Nixon never ordered a Holocaust? He never ordered the elimination of people? The fact is that he used this language. It's used to express his anger, his frustration, his envy. It's not very becoming.
The last tape that Nixon made in the White House, the last tape that you've transcribed for your piece.
Well, I think it's the last tape that he made in the White House. The last recording we have. It's on July 12th, the day that Butterfield revealed the existence of the tapes.
So his final words, Nixon's final words in a conversation with Kissinger, are, keep fighting. Mm-hmm. What's the context of that conversation and the significance of Nixon's words?
Well, it's a conversation with he and Kissinger often engage in these kind of mutual support conversations of each trying to buck up the spirits of the other. And the word I find that conversation fascinating because the word fight runs through his memoirs like a red thread. Battle, conflict. He was a combative man. He saw life as a constant struggle, and a constant battle, and a constant fight. And I was struck by the fact that these are almost his last words in this last recorded conversation. Keep fighting. The fact is that the man, when you think about it, from May 73 on, Nixon realizes the consequences for him, that if any of this cover-up is ever revealed, uncovered, that he is in serious trouble, he will probably have to resign. Yet he fights desperately. On the night of April 30th, when he fires Haldeman and Ehrlichman, there are all these very depressed, distraught conversations he has. Yet you look at the conversations of May 1st, if you listen to them, and listening to them is very much different than the spoken word often. He's very full of fight, full of energy. He's determined to fight on. And the fact is that he kept fighting from the time this taping system closed down in July 73 almost until the day he resigned. And finally, then he realized how hopeless it was. But the conversation between Kissinger and Nixon is really a kind of mutual support one.
Stanley Cutler transcribed and edited the Nixon tapes for his book, Abuse of Power. He's currently working on a Broadway play about Nixon, scheduled to open this fall. This Monday, we'll continue our look at the American presidency. We talk with Lincoln biographer Gary Wills and Thomas Jefferson's biographer, Joseph Ellis. This is Fresh Air. The Oscar nominations were announced this week, and to no one's surprise, Titanic topped the list with 14 nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director. Although he knows better, our film critic John Powers couldn't resist saying something about them.
You often hear that Hollywood is cut off from the rest of America. It's too rich, too trendy, too liberal, too cynical. Maybe so, but you'd never know it from this week's Oscar nominations. Four of the Best Picture nominees are popular favorites: Titanic, The Full Monty, Good Will Hunting, and As Good As It Gets, while the fifth, L.A. Confidential, deservedly won every year-end Critics' Prize. As always, the Academy is utterly fearless in backing frontrunners. In fact, what's striking about this year's nominees is how old-fashioned, even square, they seem. Although Boogie Nights may have been the year's most bravura piece of filmmaking, its director Paul Thomas Anderson was passed over in favor of Peter Cattaneo from The Full Monty, which has all the visual style of an episode of Seinfeld, and Good Will Hunting's Gus Van Sant, who's made the only film of his career that's predictable and utterly safe. You see, Boogie Nights is about the kind of dark subject, in this case the porn biz, that Hollywood is always leery about honoring. If Anderson is ever to get nominated, he'll have to do what Van Sant has done: make a movie where a hug can cure anything. Even more startling was the Academy's failure to nominate Rupert Everett, who played Julia Roberts' gay pal in My Best Friend's Wedding. Few supporting actors have ever done more to carry a movie than Everett, yet he was overlooked in favor of Greg Kinnear, who also plays a gay character in From As Good As It Gets. Although I can't see how anyone could think Kinnear is actually better than Everett, I can see why the Academy nominated him. Kinnear is a straight actor who plays the kind of gay character that Hollywood loves to embrace: a fey, pansy-ish victim. In contrast, Everett is an openly gay actor who plays the kind of character that makes Hollywood nervous. He's strong, exuberant, and happily gay. Like the rest of America, the film industry isn't quite ready to celebrate that. Although you might expect people who work in the film industry to be too sophisticated to fall for Oscar propaganda, the truth is they're suckers for a good story just like everyone else. They love the fact that Robert Duvall spent years and his own money making The Apostle. They love the redemptive idea that after years of neglect and terrible performances, Peter Fonda suddenly makes like his dad in Uli's Gold. And they're bowled over by the miracle that James Cameron turned into Captain Ahab while making Titanic, then managed to catch the white whale. There are very few better stories this year than The Full Monty, a low-budget sleeper that had audiences whooping and applauding. If you put everyone in the Academy on a lie detector and asked which film they honestly liked most, The Full Monty would be named Best Picture. But no $3 million Brit flick is ever going to win Hollywood's top prize, especially when it's up against a $200 million juggernaut like Titanic, which has been the number one film for 8 weeks, going on nine, and is a self-conscious throwback to the old-fashioned Hollywood spectacle found in Ben-Hur and The Ten Commandments. When I first saw Titanic, I knew that it would be a hit, but like everyone else, I never dreamed it would become such a phenomenon. This isn't just a show. It feeds many viewers' desire for transcendence. Not only does it offer a sense of community, people hear the gasps and sobs of those around them, but it apparently offers viewers an escape from themselves. Not since E.T. has a movie produced a response that is so essentially religious. In newspaper articles and on the internet, viewers actually talk about it changing their lives, transforming their ideas of ethics, love, and death. In fact, Titanic mania is becoming almost a weird kind of fundamentalism. Many of its fans are filled with a blind, unreasoning rage toward those who don't share their love for the picture. A critic I know gave the movie a review of the bad script, good shipwreck variety. She was flooded with hate mail from people who claimed, among other things, that her dislike for the love story somehow proved that she felt no compassion for the immigrants who died when the boat went down. In private, a lot of Hollywood people will say they think the movie isn't really all that good. But despite these whispers of an anti-Titanic backlash, there's no chance the Academy will offend the public by baldly going against the zeitgeist. So when you're filling in your entry for your office Oscar pool, just check Titanic for almost everything, and then pray you can guess the correct animated short.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Roberta Shirock, Monique Nazareth, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Sarah Scher is our researcher, Dorothy Farabee, our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Putumayo World Music, presenting Romantica, great love songs from around the world, available at cafes, record, gift, and bookstores worldwide, 1-888-788-8629. This is NPR, National Public Radio.